American 15-year-olds rank 24th out of 29 countries in mathematical literacy. Only 57% of adult Americans read a nonfiction book in a year. Americans are as likely to believe in flying saucers as in evolution. Depending on how the questions are asked, roughly 30 to 40% of Americans believe in each. A 34-nation study found Americans less likely to believe in evolution than citizens of any of the countries polled except Turkey. And even our president, George Bush, says the jury is still out. In the summer of 2005, nearly two-thirds of Americans told pollsters they believed creationism should be taught in schools alongside Darwinian evolution. Steve Colbert recently interviewed Georgia Rep. Lynn Westmoreland on the Colbert Report. Westmoreland had co-sponsored a bill that would require the display of the Ten Commandments in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, but when she was asked, couldn't actually list the commandments. Now, this stuff would be funny if it weren't so tragic or dangerous. And where the danger really showed up for me is after the 2004 election. According to the Program in International Policy Attitudes, University of Maryland, among Bush supporters in the 2004 election, nearly 70% believed the U.S. had clear evidence that Saddam Hussein was working closely with al-Qaeda. A third believed weapons of mass destruction had been found in Iraq, and more than a third that a substantial majority of world opinion supported the U.S.-led invasion. We can assume that they were similarly uninformed about who benefits from Bush tax cuts, the success or meaning of No Child Left Behind, clear skies, healthy forests, etc., etc., etc. I believe that this isn't accidental. I believe there's been a concerted effort on the part of political and cultural advocates to encourage misinformation and the ignoring of evidence. And in addition, their labeling of intelligent and informed as elite and effete implies that ignorance is somehow both valuable and under attack. I also believe that to ignore evidence, scientific as well as simply factual, is primitive, pathological, suicidal, and an unfit way to run the world. Today's guest, Susan Jacoby, has written a book about this, The Age of American Unreason. A former reporter for the Washington Post and program director of the Center for Inquiry in New York City, Susan Jacoby is the author of five books, including Wild Justice, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and Free Thinkers, A History of American Secularism. Her political blog, The Secularist Corner, is on the website of the Washington Post. And as I say, her new book is The Age of American Unreason. And her website is Susan Jacoby, SusanJacoby, SusanJacoby.com. Welcome, Susan Jacoby.
Happy to be talking to you from the other side of the continent, the right coast.
Exactly. And we met when you were out here at the library, so at least we have that sort of connection. Let me ask, I like people to get a feeling for the people besides the ideas and the work that we talk about. Let me ask you, how were some things different when you were growing up?
Well, I have just been told, by the way, in many emails that all of my memories of growing up are wrong. because memory is absolutely inaccurate, and it's only a narrative. And when I say that something happened, I will give you an example of how stupid this country has become. In a recent post in the Washington Post, I'm a panelist for On Faith.
Right.
I'm one of the village atheists on that panel, sponsored by the Washington Post and Newsweek. I mentioned that I began questioning what I'd been taught about religion when I was seven. I'm old enough so that I grew up when polio was still a real threat to children, before the Salk vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taken when I was 7 years old by my mom to visit a friend who had been stricken by polio in an iron lung. And hopefully most of your audience doesn't know what an iron lung is anymore, because polio has basically been eradicated. But this was a childhood friend who had been playing and running only 3 weeks before, and he was an iron lung. And I asked my mom, why would God let something like that happen? And to her credit, my mother said, I don't know, instead of giving me some stupid, moronic answer. I received an email after posting this in a long thing on Faith saying, well, you know, all childhood memories are unreliable. We all construct narratives to justify what we now think. And I had not said in this post that I became an atheist when I saw this. What I said was, is I remembered this childhood experience as making me, you know, begin to question what I had been taught about religion. If I said I became an atheist at the age of 7, of course, it would be stupid. But the whole tone of the email I got was is that nobody's memory about anything could possibly be accurate. No fact could possibly be untrue.
Now, what's interesting, I must say, Susan, about that, is that that email stating that sort of relativistic way of looking at things and doesn't sound like that's from, you know, the typical person who doesn't believe in evolution and believes in flying saucers. You get what I'm saying? In other words, this seems like an attack on rationality from a rational person.
That's right. And one of the points I make in my book and why it's taken, and I'm proud of this, it's taken so much flack from both the right and the left, is that unreason is something that pervades our culture, and it is not just a matter of right-wing religious fundamentalism. There is all kinds of unreason, suspicion of evidence from both the right and the left. And the idea that there is no way you can think about anything rationally, that it's all a matter of opinion.
Right. I was going. One of my questions was going to be exactly that. How do you find that you certainly do find both right and left guilty? And so we've actually uncovered one of those ways from that email. Let me ask you what I said in my intro, Susan, about the revelations post the 2004 election, which sent me into such a downspin. Not the result, but the fact that misinformation, it seemed to me, certainly played a crucial role in a close election. That kind of misinformation is struck me as being almost the deciding factor. And I worry about not just the absence of information or knowledge or a pursuit of knowledge, but an active disparagement of those who would favor that sort of thing. Do you see that at play?
Well, yes. And I think that we can see. I hope maybe this will dim down a little bit after the end of the Democratic primary. But contempt for facts is very important. I'll give you a great example of it, and it's already obsolete. During the end of the Democratic primary, both Hillary Clinton and John McCain endorsed a gas tax holiday for Americans this summer. Every economist, both liberal and conservative, which again shows that anti-rationalism is not a right-wing or a left-wing thing, every economist said this would do nothing to help matters. And what did Hillary Clinton say when she was asked a question by the late Tim Russert, a shock that just happened today as we're talking on tape? When Hillary Clinton was asked, can you produce one economist to support the gas tax holiday? She said, oh, that's elite thinking. Now, to say that economists have nothing intelligent to say about whether a gas tax will give people economic relief, it's like saying that you don't ask musicians about music, you don't ask scientists about science. It's not just an attack on a political idea, it's an attack on knowledge itself.
And also the fact that this is from a woman who placed, I believe, in the top 5 at Yale Law School.
Of course, she doesn't believe that for a minute. What it shows is that a lot of politicians think that they have to play to ignorance and label anything that goes against received opinion as elitism, that that's how to get elected. On the gas tax, by the way, I was quite encouraged. It didn't work.
That's right.
The actual majority of Americans, both those who were Republicans and Democrats, said that the gas tax was just a stupid gimmick.
Right. They were already getting their tax rebate checks, which they knew were a jerk off.
Yeah, that's right.
Now you're going to, at a certain point they see through this. But this point that we see there, Hillary Clinton joining others in, that somehow evidence, intelligence, rationality is...
That's elitism.
Yeah.
That's elitism. By the way, all elite means is the best.
I know.
The real meaning of elite is not the political meaning
that's been
ascribed to it.
That's right. The now there is a connotation that has more I think, more meaning to most people who hear that word than the definition of the word itself. And that connotation is somehow stuffy, superior, arrogant, most important, not one of us. In some ways, I think even un-American.
Un-American. But of course, the same people, if they just knew that elite just means the best, I mean, if you're having an operation, you don't want an ordinary surgeon, you want an elite surgeon.
Well, not only that,
you want the best.
The same person who would say that would then say the falsehood that America has the best health care.
Right. Right.
Which we know isn't true, but of course, most people don't know isn't true because it is repeated in any discussion of health care.
These things that seem like such dry statistics. For example, you mentioned it in your introduction that American 15-year-olds are near the bottom in mathematical knowledge compared with people from other countries. Well, to understand, for example, about taxes and what percentage of Americans are getting tax breaks, which is the top 1% of income earners, you have to know what 1% means. And not knowing anything about math means you don't understand percentages and fractions. So these kinds of basic knowledge deficits do really affect our ability to understand larger public issues.
Right. Now, let me read a quick quote from Richard Hofstadter's 1963 book. And I don't have the title right in front of me.
Anti-intellectualism in American Life.
Yeah, there we go. Anti-intellectualism in American Life. He described anti-intellectualism as older than our national identity and deeply rooted in our history. Yet we have a set of founders who developed a form of government that it would seem would most necessitate an informed citizenry. How do these two things fit together?
Well, that's really the American paradox. And at the time that Hofstadter wrote his book, which was in the late 1950s, it was published in 1963, he talked about anti-intellectualism historically and often talked about it sometimes as the flip side of good things. For example, America, there's no country that has had more faith in education as an instrument of social mobility. There is no country in the West that democratized education earlier. But there is also no country that has been more suspicious of too much education. So we've always thought of education as something, it's good if it gets you a better job, but it's bad if it makes you think too much. And so that is an American paradox. But one of the things that's happened that I talk about in my book, which Hofstadter could not have talked about, because he was still writing at the dawn of the video culture, the domination of culture by mass media and video and 24/7 infotainment. That is something that has been added in the last 40 years to the old American mix, which has made everything much worse, because the video culture is the worst possible means for understanding anything that's more complicated than a video soundbite.
Mm-hmm. I remember a book came out a few years ago called A Soundbite Society, and it basically said what you've just said, that the nature of the way that communication is produced and received elevates simplicity to, in some sense, the highest order. And so, in some sense, it just prefers simplistic arguments over complexity, and that very often seems to favor the less nuance, less complexity, and thus simple solutions, simple answers.
Well, look, as we are talking, I happen to have my computer on, and there are news stories flashing on the screen and going off. And even if I weren't talking to you, I couldn't see them because they go off so fast. So naturally, when anything is flashing at you and you're not reading it out, if it goes away in 2 seconds, you're going to miss a lot. And that is the problem of the video culture, and the problem of the video culture as translated through computers.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, all that information at our fingertips is a plus, but all
right.
That information what would be the term you'd say? How do you phrase the negative?
Well, what I would say is this. Is the ability to get quick information is great. I love it that I don't have to go through half a dozen books to find out a date that I've forgotten. But if you don't have a framework of knowledge in which to fit that information, it means nothing. I'll give you a great example. I've saved all of my emails about this. One of the things I often say in my talks to people is I mention a statistic, the National Constitution Center, that almost half of Americans can't name even one of the rights guaranteed by the First Amendment. And a student stood up, this was actually a university in California, and said, that doesn't matter because you could just look it up on the Internet. That's true. But if you don't know what the First Amendment is in the first place, you don't know what question to ask the web.
Right, right. And
that's the whole point. You know, garbage in, garbage out. The web is only as good as our ability to ask questions of it and to fit it into a framework of knowledge we already have.
Right.
And if we don't know a thing, the web is useless.
Right. And as you said, to know that there's something there you want to know.
Exactly.
And to know that there's something there that impacts you, and to know there's something there which has something to say about something else, if you lack that that point of origin, it's a much vaster wasteland than we used to have.
Right. It's not that there's anything. The ability to access information is a great thing, but it means nothing if you don't have a educated, knowledgeable framework to fit it into.
Now, since we're not going to roll back the clock on television, and we're not going to roll
right.
back the clock the clock on the Internet.
And we shouldn't.
I mean, I don't know if I want to get to prescription already, so let me just set that aside. Let me go back. So why America? In other words, the other countries have television. Other
right.
countries
that,
have the Internet.
That's a great question.
And
because,
other countries have some of the same traditions.
The network of infotainment has no national boundaries. It's all over the world. There are a couple of things that make America particularly susceptible to this. One is that although fundamentalists, religious fundamentalists, do not make up a majority, they make up one-third of America, a fundamentalist is someone who believes in a literal interpretation of sacred books.
And you're saying a third of Americans, not just a third of religious,
believe
a third
in a
of
literal
Americans.
Interpretation of the Bible. It is entirely possible, this is about 10 times more than in any other developed country in the world, it's entirely possible to be a religious believer and to also accept science. It's not possible to be a literal religious believer, to literally believe that the world was created in 6 days and be open to modern knowledge. So there's that. There's also something else in America, and I think this is true. We have always had more faith in technology than any other country, and one of our problems with computers is that we believe in technological solutions to what are essentially non-technological problems. In other words, this email I was telling you about is a perfect example of it. I don't need to know what rights are guaranteed by the First Amendment because I can look it up on the web. But if I don't know what the First Amendment is, what do I know what to look for? In other words, not knowing that is a non-technological problem. The idea that the web is an answer to knowing nothing is wrong, but it's something that Americans, with our history of believing in technology as a solution to everything, are particularly susceptible to.
Okay, well, I was beginning to feel like the child who wants to say, but why, because it seems to me underneath you say that Americans have a much larger percentage who believe in the literal words of holy books.
Right,
why?
And that's one element.
But why? Why do we know what, I mean, in your investigations, have you come up with some sense of why that is?
That's my previous book, Freethinkers. there's one reason for this, which, oddly enough, is our absolute separation of church and state. In secular Europe, as it's often called sneeringly by people
right.
like Justice Antonin Scalia, religious belief and belief in political systems were united. In other words, there was unity of church and state. So if you oppose the government, you also had to oppose religion. That was not true in America because we had separation of church and state. So that many forms of religious belief survived in America because you could believe anything you want and still not be opposed to your government. But in secular Europe, if you were opposed to your government also meant necessarily being opposed to religion. It's kind of the law of unintended consequences.
So in other words, because religion wasn't tied to government, we had more freedom.
We have more religion.
And so
that's right.
So people just end up, there's not an axe to grind about it, so people can go do it. So in other words, when you really drill down on it, that's why we have more fundamentalists, just because that seems so. What is it in
it's
our
not,
culture?
It's not the only reason, but it's an important reason.
Is our isolation part of it?
You anticipated what I was going to say. There's also the idea of American exceptionalism, that America is different from every other country. God blessed. Our system sanctioned by God to be different from the old world. And I am sure, by the way, that in fact I've had again many emails. I've had thousands of emails since my book was published. And one of them and one of the things I say in my book is Americans are unwilling to look at how really bad our educational system is because we've all been propagandized with the idea that we're number one, which in fact was true after World War II. But the truth is that we are not number one educationally in the world anymore. But the idea that we're number one and special and better than everybody else, it's a very powerful factor in American life, and it prevents us from examining certain respects in which we're not number one.
Right. I've referred to healthcare before. You refer to education now. And there are many of these things which people, politicians in particular, sort of preface any comment by saying, well, of course, we have the best education system. We have the best healthcare. We have the best this and that. And
yeah, but we don't.
People accept it even though it is no longer true. And we have clear evidence that it is no longer true.
You use that word evidence again.
I know.
But evidence involving infant mortality, life expectancy. The fact is that whatever opinions people have about our health care system, we, by all of the normal indices of health, we are worse than Europe and Canada. It is very true that the very rich in this country get the best health care in the world.
And that our universities, and particularly our graduate schools, are perhaps still the envy of the world. But it's when you get to what is available to everyone.
Exactly.
That it no longer is so, and yet it is still believed rather than being based on evidence.
Right. And by the way, to call arguments like mine elitist are wrong, because I am not really concerned that much with what graduates of Yale and Harvard Law School know. I think that the basis of a society is what people who have normal levels of education understand. And what that means here is we need to be concerned about elementary school education, secondary school education, and community colleges, not what people at Harvard and Yale are learning.
Right, right. So let's now, we've got about 2.5 minutes. What are the possible solutions?
Oh, I hate it that you asked that question. My publisher asked that question too. There are solutions at a social level, but they have to begin at an individual level. I was actually very encouraged. Now it seems like 100 years ago, after the Wisconsin primary, whenever that was, Barack Obama was asked a question about education. And he said, well, there is a lot we can do about education. But he said, first of all, in our homes, we have to turn off the TV more.
I saw that.
Turn off the TV altogether.
Right.
Turn it off more. Put the video games on the shelf more. Spend more time talking to our kids and reading to our kids. That's true. And one of the things I wanted to do in my book was not to make a prescription, but to start a cultural conversation about how we spend our time. And I am not one of these people who thinks that you should raise your kids without ever watching TV. We all have to live in the world of our time. What I'm saying is people ought to look at both adults and in terms of what their children are doing, but how much time we spend on this. There is nothing wrong with a parent coming home and putting a kid in front of a video for an hour so they can have a drink and an intelligent conversation with their partner. What is wrong is, haven't we all done that? What is wrong is when the hour turns into 2 hours or 3 hours or 4 hours or 5 hours.
Right.
As it does in too many American homes.
When it becomes just a habit.
I know it's a very unfashionable and it seems like a small idea, but I think what matters far more than what people watch on video is how much they watch it.
Right. And one thing that you didn't mention is that the other finding that as kids become more addicted to television and other screens, they become less familiar with nature, with their own bodies, with what we would call the real world. Let me finally ask this last question, which is that it strikes me that intelligence has been defined by so many as sort of just cognitive brainiac intelligence. Is there something to be said that intelligence is both includes emotional intelligence and other forms of intelligence, and that's part of the solution is if we can begin to shift that way of thinking about it?
No.
No.
because the fact is we all have emotional intelligence, and that depends largely on, you know, are we brought up kindly and do we learn to empathize with other people? I don't actually recognize these different forms of intelligence. It doesn't matter if you're kind to others and you understand them if you don't know anything about your society and history. These are actually, they're different things. And my point is, one of them doesn't substitute for the other. They're all important, but having emotional intelligence without knowledge is useless in terms of a society. And, of course, having knowledge without emotional intelligence is also useless. But they're not the same thing. Although I have to say that I think spending 8 hours a day in front of television, which is the amount of time the average American family has a television on in its home, probably is bad for both emotional intelligence and knowledge. I don't think these things are in opposition at all. They're both necessary. Neither of them is adequate without the other.
Very good. The book is The Age of American Unreason. The website is SusanJacoby.com. That's JACOBY. Thank you, Susan Jacoby. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Okay.